I don't know about you, but it feels like a lot of my friends are now getting on that baby train. If you have a friend who is also expecting or have little ones still in diapers, I always recommend Pampers Swaddlers. With Pampers Swaddlers, you can also rest assured that this diaper will prevent up to 100% of leaks, even blowouts. Swaddlers has dual leak guard barriers at the legs to help protect where leaks happen most, and they have a blowout barrier, which is an innovative back pocket built into the diaper to help prevent those messy leaks up the back. Did you know that on average, babies will use up to 8,000 plus diapers before becoming potty trained? That is a lot. That's why Pampers Diaper Stash is the hottest baby gift for 2024. So give a gift to a loved one that says, "We see you and we've got you." Pampers Diaper Stash is an online diaper fund that all parents with little ones will love. You can organize friends and family to contribute to a group gift of an online stockpile that never has to run out. Pampers Diaper Stash is great because it takes the guesswork out of choosing what size and how many diapers to gift. It's so easy to do, and it's the gift that always fits.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to ABG, a podcast for the modern day Asian American woman. My name is Helen.
I'm Janet,
and it's Mel. Hi everyone. Today's actually a very special day for us. It's the first time we're having a female guest on our podcast. She is an Asian American woman that has been using her creative abilities to really make an impact on this world.
Welcome, Krista Suh, a feminist, an artist, a Hollywood screenwriter, the creator of the Pussy App Project, and author of DIY Rules for a WTF World. For those in our audience who are following the Women's March movement, you may have noticed the bright pink hats that many people were wearing at the 600-plus rallies around the world. Well, Krista is the individual responsible for creating and distributing the design and essentially empowering millions of people around the world to make and wear this symbol of solidarity in support of women's and human rights. So welcome, Krista.
Welcome for joining us.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
Okay, so we're just going to jump right in because we have a lot of questions for you today. So I know you've detailed on your website and in your book, but for those who are listening and maybe are not as familiar with your work, can you tell us a little bit about the Pussy App Project and how you came up with the idea?
Sure. I was really devastated by the results of the election in 2016. I was fully ready for our first woman president. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you guys remember that night, how like shocking it was. I remember going to bed thinking like, oh my God, this can't be happening. I was really devastated, really demoralized. But that same week, news of the Women's March came up and I knew I would go just immediately. I was trying to figure out what I could do. Like, was there something more I could do than just show up? What could I wear? What sign could I hold up? Just thinking really visually, because one photograph nowadays can change the world, like one visual. Right. Backing up a second, I was really proud of myself because I was so fueled. I was like, damn, like I would march naked for this. Like, you know, like I'm really committed. But, you know, there was no like meaning to being naked. So I was like, okay. And then I had kind of this gentle teasing voice come up. That voice was like, okay, Krista, maybe you would march naked in LA in January. I don't know if you're going to march naked in DC in January, right? I don't know about you guys, but I grew up in Southern California like pretty much all my life. I never checked the weather. So I was like, oh yeah, I have to actually dress for cold. So, you know, that meant like a winter coat and like gloves and a scarf and a hat. And I thought, oh, I can knit my own hat. And that's something that I had been really obsessed with at the time, knitting. So that felt right. Like I could make my own protest gear with my own hands.
So you did the opposite of going naked.
Yes. I got really warm and cozy, actually. Yeah. That just felt so meaningful, you know, and really empowering that like, oh, like not only can I make a statement, I could really make it, like literally. And I also thought of the American flag was made by Betsy Ross, right? With her own two hands. And in some ways, that's our nation's first piece of protest gear, and it was made by a woman. So I was like, oh my God, this is it. There's something to it. My next thought, it was really, it was that lightning bolt moment. It was like, oh, like I'm a beginner knitter. If I can make this hat, anyone could. And that's when it went from one to many. Like I could see a sea of pink at the march. And that felt really like I was just so jazzed, you know, when you have a great idea. And I immediately texted my friend Kat, who owns a yarn store, and she knows how to make patterns and all this. She teaches me how to knit and crochet. I texted her immediately with like all caps, all these emojis. I was like, I just had the best idea ever. You have to help me. Oh my God. And so when I got back to the store, we got started and we really spread it. So it was a way to capture all the feelings I had in a communal way.
And how did you even have the idea to like start? Like, who did you reach out to in DC to start like distributing your manifesto in terms of like how to actually knit this?
Great question. Kat was actually an amazing resource in many ways because she's really plugged into the crafting community. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people like feel like it came out of nowhere, but anyone who's done like crafting or knitting or crocheting, sewing, like they're like, oh, like of course this happened, because women, like I didn't reinvent the wheel. There's already a community of crafters out there. And I kind of just asked them if they'd be willing to be craftivist for this march.
So your friend was already kind of plugged into that community. Like, was she in like different social media like groups?
Yeah, I mean, you guys like spools people over. There's a whole different social media platform, you could call it, just for knitters. It's called Ravelry, and there's 8 million people on it.
Oh, wow. What's the demographic, age demographic of that?
I don't know. But actually, on my book tour, I go to all the different, all these different yarn stores that are part of the movement. Mm. And I would say, like, a lot of the women who go to these events are women in their 50s or 60s.
Right, yeah.
So a lot of older women are a part of it. I get emails from older women, and I love it because any woman over the age of, like, 65 always like to tell me their age. Like, I'm a 70-year-old black woman and I wore a pussy. Or like, I'm an 80-year-old Minnesotan and I made 70 pussy hats or something. Like, you know, just like they always state their age. It's so cool.
That's true, because you have like this group of people who are retired, a lot of them who have this like passion for knitting, and here you are, you're like, I need an army of people to just help me knit this and like distribute it.
Well, also knitters just really, and I when I say knitters, I kind of am like yarnies or just all these people who craft and knit. Knitters just really love to help. Like, I don't know if any of you guys have ever received a handmade gift from a knitter. They love giving out what they make and like clothing people and sheltering people with that. Mm-hmm. So it's like a really human basic instinct, I think, that I asked them to apply this time toward the women's movement. I didn't have to like teach people how to come together to do this, because it's not like I had to like send all these emails like, hey guys, like get together with your friends and sew hats and talk about the issues, because there's already such thing as a stitch and bitch. So so I didn't have to invent that. Another thing I did not have to invent is like, hey guys, when you're like starting to make your pussy hat, maybe like take a picture and put it on social media to spread the word, because there's already such thing as like casting on. Casting on is when you start. Mm-hmm. And then so people be like, I'm casting on for this project. It's like, I did not have to like ask them to do that. They just did that on their own.
Right. That's so cool.
Yeah. And you know, the cool thing about it too is that it is really simple. Like, you know, I keep talking about knitters, but this is really about women's rights supporters who took part, whether they were making them, wearing them, spreading the word. And making them was something that you could learn how to do, like, in those 2 months, you know? And a lot of people learned how to knit for the first time.
That is an amazing backstory. Can you tell us a little bit about the design, the specific design of the hat itself, and then how that kind of arrived?
Yeah, a lot of people think, like, oh, it's a pussy hat. It's anti-Trump, right? And I think people have this idea that we went through Trump's greatest hits, like the worst things he said, and just like, how do we react to that in a clever way? But that it actually was way more organic than that. So when I got to the yarn store and went over things with Kat and the other people in the store, the first thing we decided on was the color. The color is pink. I think we did discuss, like, should it be purple? Should it be this? But ultimately, I really wanted to embrace the fact that it was feminine. Mm-hmm. Because I think no matter what color we chose, if it was considered feminine, it'd be considered weak or lesser. You know, we got a lot of criticism, you know, from people who were, I call them the dignity crew. Mm-hmm. They were like, no, we can't wear pink. We need something more dignified. How about these, like, blue... baseball caps made in China. We could all buy these and wear them. I'm like, oh, I don't think you get it. That's like, you know. And after I dropped pre-med, I became an art history major. And so I can tell you that a couple hundred years ago, it was actually totally reversed. Blue was the color of women, mm-hmm. and pink was the color of men. Blue was feminine, of course, because it was oceanic and demure and calm and peaceful. Mm. And the Virgin Mary always wore blue robes, and it was a very expensive color to make. Whereas men were red, and pink was the offshoot of red, right? So, and they were like fiery and warlike and blood and gore, mm-hmm. and all these things. So it was like tough. So mm-hmm. obviously pink was for men, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, I say. And then, so I guarantee you that if that was still the case today, if we wore blue pussy hats, people would be like, oh my God, can't you do something more dignified like pink? You know, right, so it doesn't matter what color is associated with women. Whatever is associated with women right now is considered lesser. And I wanted to like throw that into like under the spotlight and question mm-hmm. that and run right into it. Mm-hmm. So it was pink. Secondly, it was cat ears. And it actually came from more of a design place at first, where I just really wanted a different silhouette. I don't know if you guys do a lot of networking in your jobs, but if I go to a networking event and I know everyone's going to wear pantsuits, I'll wear a dress. And it's not because it's more feminine or whatever. It's because it stands out because of the silhouette. Mm-hmm. Whereas everyone's going to wear dresses, I'm going to wear, like, you know, a suit, a pantsuit. So it's just a really great, easy way to stand out, because I think more than color, more than print, your eye is drawn to different lines.
Right. Yeah.
So I really wanted cat ears instead of like the normal sort of beanie with a pom-pom on top. Mm-hmm. But when I asked Kat, like, look, I want it to be really easy to make. And because I see beanies with pom-poms on top everywhere, I guess that's the easiest thing to make. So I'm willing to let go of the cat ears because I don't want people spend extra time making cat ears. Mm-hmm. And she's like, oh, no, cat ears are the easiest thing to make. So I was like, oh, my God. Like, it's just so meant to be. So it was pink, cat ears, and the last thing was the name. And so just like, you know, I didn't want to be naked without meaning. I didn't want it to be cat ears without meaning. So I asked the people in the yarn store, like, all right, like, what is the meaning behind cat ears? Hmm. And it was silent, silent, silent. And then Kat Coyle, she speaks up and she says, it's the pussy power hat. And we're like, oh my God, that's it. That's perfect. It. And it's like, it just all came together. And I'm so glad you asked that question, because sometimes it's hard for me to talk about in that, to convey how intentional it was, but also how lucky it was. Mm-hmm. It's like, we really thought through every detail, mm-hmm. but we were also so lucky and blessed that it's like, oh my gosh, cat ears are easy to make. Oh, wait, this name is working out. And of course, like the pussy hat, the name really worked because it had a charge to it.
Yeah.
And it did relate to Trump, and that his recent leaked comments on the Access Hollywood tape where he says, like, grab him by the pussy. Mm-hmm. So it was a good way to relate to it. But just like the whole movement itself, like, yeah, it's about Trump, it's about so much more than that. It's mm-hmm. about women's rights and women's respect.
I actually had a follow-up question to that. I feel like language is something that drives a lot of thinking, or how we think in society.
I agree.
Right? If you think about it, like, history is his story. Mm-hmm. Mankind is mankind.
But or, like, it masterpiece versus, like, mistress piece. So,
right.
Yeah.
No, exactly. And so I feel like male privilege is embedded not just in our system of thought, but in the language that we use. So some people say the word bitch should go the way of, like, the N-word, where women can use that their discretion, but not men, because it carries with it centuries of repression. So do you feel the same way about the word pussy? Do you feel like women can only use it, or do you feel discomfort when men use the word pussy because of this movement, because of this project, and how women are sort of, you know, taking the word back for ourselves?
I know exactly what you're talking about. A lot of men ask me this, like, am I allowed to say the word pussy? Right. Like, as if, like, yeah, everyone has to go through me, like, and I can say yes or no. I really appreciate when anyone uses the word pussy hat. I also think, like, with so much, tone and context mean a lot. How are you using that word, right? Mm-hmm. There's a book I talk about in my book, like, very meta. It's her name is Regina Thomas Howard. She wrote a book called Pussy. Mm-hmm. And for her, pussy means, like, the feminine life force. You know, divine feminine. It's like that womanly intuition that we all have. That you don't, by the way, need a literal, like, vagina and uterus and vulva to have or explore. So for me, that's what pussy means. But for a lot of people, pussy means a weak person, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I really want to take that out of, similar to the N-word, right? Right. Like, I think it depends how you use it. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, with, like, a lot of language change, it can take some time. Not, it doesn't have to take a ton of time, but I think sort of in phases, right? So I think the first phase, yeah, like, I think probably women can use it and explore how they want to use it. Like, I have this a thing, an exercise in my book I call pussy schedules, because it's just about me, like, not over-scheduling my day and instead just following my pussy. Like, what does my pussy want to do today? Like, you know? And it's, like, it's really helpful for decisions because it's, like, I don't know, does my pussy want to do it? Like, you know?
The power to your pussy.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I think probably for a little bit it's going to be, like, a woman's word or, like, a female-identifying person's word. But we're not there yet, but, you know, in order to get there, like, no matter where you fall on the spectrum, like, the feminine has to be way more respected, because we talk about feminism, right? And it's like, oh, women's rights. Mm-hmm. But really, like, it's the feminine, the femininity that is being disrespected in all of us, men, women, in between, right? Mm-hmm. So anyway, I think that, like, as pussy grows to mean something more about, like, feminine divine intuition, like, probably all people can use that word. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's really about the intention behind it, mm-hmm. and how you use the word. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So can you share a little bit about yourself, maybe where you grew up, your cultural background? So I know in your book you said you're half Korean, half Chinese, and that you grew up in a sort of tiger mom household. So myself, Janet, and Mel, we also grew up in fairly traditional Asian households. And our parents have always encouraged us to, like, put our head down, work hard, not disrupt the patriarchy. And here you are, like, stirring up controversy, having a voice, and speaking out against men, yeah. Which for, if that were me, my parents would be like, what are you doing? Right? So what do your parents actually, like, think about this?
You know, it's interesting. I think I kind of gave my parents boot camp when I decided to become a screenwriter, because they went through all this already with, like, oh my God, you're going to be what? You know? Yeah. And so when I started doing the pussy hat, it was a little bit like, it wasn't their first rodeo, you know? And it wasn't mine either. I think it was easier for me to be an activist or become an activist in the last couple years, because about 10 years ago, I went against what my loved ones wanted for me. Mm-hmm. You know, they wanted me to be safe. They wanted me to be pre-med or something, right? And when I went against what they wanted for me, that was really hard.
Yeah.
And so, you know, fast forward 10 years, I'm like 29 years old and I have this idea for the pussy hat. And at that point, it's like, well, I think being an activist is like you have to go against what a lot of people think, mm-hmm. sometimes. And because I'd already done that with people I love, it was so easy to do that against, like, the alt-right and Trump, because, right. you know, these are people who don't care about me. It's like, yeah. well, yeah, I can speak up. I mean, I would say I was, like, such the cliche Asian American kid. Mm-hmm. I was a black belt in Taekwondo. I took piano. I got, like, straight A's, and I went to Troy High School in Orange County. Yeah. So
That means.
You get tested into the high school. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's a public magnet school. Okay. I think it's actually they're responsible for this thing called bright flight. Do you know what that is?
No.
So, you know, white flight is when, like, minorities move in and, like, right. white people leave. Uh-huh. Bright flight is, like, so it's a public school. Right? And you have to test to get in. And they literally, like, steal, like, the brightest kids from all the surrounding districts and gather them.
I actually, like, went to a school like that, too, in Boston.
Yeah.
Boston Latin schools. You had to test in to get in.
And, yeah. like, how many of those, like, people testing in were Asian, right? Like,
a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was really pressure cooker high school experience. Mm. I went to an Ivy League Seven Sisters school in New York. I went to Barnard College of Columbia University. And when I was there, I was supposed to be I was pre-med. And I thought I was making these choices on my own.
Yeah.
And my parents are, like, the ultimate tiger mom and dad in that they made me think I was choosing it. It was like Jedi level, like Tiger Mom, right? Where I was like, yeah, no, I want the best for myself. I'm going to be pre-med. I'm really smart and I can handle this. And the whole idea was I would be pre-med just in case. The idea being like, I'm going to explore other things, but, you know, just to be safe, I'm going to take all my pre-med courses. So if I don't find something that really fits, I'll have it ready to go. Mm-hmm. But what I found was that being pre-med just in case, there's no such thing. You're just pre-med, yeah, like, you know, and I didn't have any
too much work.
Yeah. Right. And I didn't have any time to explore outside of that. So my sophomore year, when it's time to declare your major, I called up my parents. I remember like really like bolstering myself, like, okay, Krista, you can do this. Like, I close the door to my dorm room and like I make a quiet space for myself and I call them. I'm going to tell them I'm not going to be pre-med, right? Mm-hmm. And so they're both on the phone. I tell them and they're like, that's okay. I'm like, what? Yeah. Wow. I was like, yeah, right? No, yeah, I was like, what? Well, here's the thing. They were like, you can be pre-law instead. I'm like, oh, like, oh my God. And I actually was. I actually took the LSAT and everything because I was like,
oh my gosh,
you know,
really?
Yeah, I got a 98th percentile. Just saying. I remember the day it expired too, because it expires 5 years after you take it. I'm like, I guess that's really not happening anymore. Like,
you talk about your background. I think a lot of our listeners can relate because we kind of grew up with that Tiger Mom or these Asian American expectations on us. For me personally, I feel like in my family, we never talked about American politics. I was never educated on it. We talked about like Taiwanese politics, some Taiwanese, but like, how did you get involved in like activism and politics? And like, how can our listeners get, I guess, more engaged with that world?
Well, I think as a broad stroke thing is that, first of all, like anything is learnable. Like everything is figure outable. I wanted to be a part of this like humorous comedy writing community, and like I bought a book that was like how to be funny even if you're not.
Oh,
yeah, like, but you know, but it's like that kind of like beginner's mindset of just like it's okay to be a beginner, whether it's politics or humor or like even frankly like dressing well, like stylishly. I was like, it seems like sometimes like you're either born with it or you're not, and that's not true. Like all these things, people learned it. And so same with politics. I feel like we're all so smart. I mean, that it's not like about like, oh, do you know enough about the issues or not? Because I think being political is like, yes, you need to know the issues, but you also like a big part of being considered political is speaking up about the issues. So really, like, I think what you're asking me, Mel, isn't like, how do I become more political? It's like, no, you already are political. It's like, how do I get the confidence though to speak up about what I believe in? Or how do I take the time to like really have confidence in myself to know I can come up with my own opinion about this? Right? I think that's what my book really goes into, because I didn't consider myself political for a long time, like, you know. And I think a lot of people didn't, actually, until the November 2016 election. I will say, though, I think I've always felt, like, annoyed that women didn't get their due, but I didn't really have, like, an outlet for it, right? So I talk about this in my book a bit, but it's kind of like one of my Me Too stories in a way. Like, in 2016, like, spring, Los Angeles Metro finally connected Santa Monica and LA, downtown LA. I don't know if you guys remember this, but it was a big deal. And that weekend, everyone was riding it like for free, and it was like very celebratory. I ride that train, and this guy in the car starts masturbating at me.
What?
And, yeah. Okay. Like, I could, like, that's a whole nother podcast. I won't feel like saying, like, I didn't feel safe, right?
Yeah.
And then as I got out of the car at my stop, this other man, like, totally different scenario now, like, starts following me and blocking my exits. And he never touches me, but he's always, like, if I go this way, he's, like, blocking that exit and so on, right? And talking to me the whole time about how he's going to take me to this motel room, what he's going to do to me and all this. And, like, by the way, here I am trying to be, like, frugal and save money. And I'm like, oh, my God, like, I have to call Lyft right now. And I literally had to close the door on this guy. Like, he was, like, about to come into the car with me. I was like, bam, oh, you know? And so I get home and I'm just really I mean, so many emotions, right? I'm like angry, I feel violated, I feel sad. And, you know, women are often accused of being like, oh, too emotional, right? Which is a whole nother thing. Like, men are so emotional, seriously. But but I remember thinking like, oh, people, what if people don't listen to me because, you know, of all these emotions? And then it hit me that all right, for me to get home safely that night, it would have cost me $20, right? Yeah. Had I just gotten a lift from the very beginning. But for a man to get home safely, it would have cost him $2. And like, never mind how I feel, how you feel, like just looking at those numbers, like how is that fair, right? Yeah. And that was the first night I didn't know what to do. I wanted to do something. And I like opened my computer and went to the Hillary Clinton website and just like donated money. I was like, I won't stand for this anymore. Like, you know, so I donated my money to her. I also started campaigning for her, like first locally. And then I flew out to Ohio.
You connected a personal experience.
Yeah. Experience, exactly. And when we were canvassing in Ohio, I was scared. I was like, oh my God, I don't know enough about the issues. I certainly don't know enough about like local Ohio issues. And what they said to us, like when they trained us and such, was that like, just make it personal because that's real. Like, you know, that's authentic and it's the truth and it's valid. The personal is political for sure. So it's about getting more confidence, but it's also about a shift in your mind of like actually valuing your life and understanding that it's worth fighting for. Because I think too often, especially immigrants and children of immigrants are like, well, who would care about my little issue here, like, or my commute, for example, like, you know? But, like, some people are like, oh, my God, this commute's horrible. What's my local politician doing about it, right? But we don't think that way. No, we're like, oh, gotta suck it up, you know?
We're accustomed to, like, bending to rules versus knowing that we can set the rules.
Yeah, right? Or, like, knowing that we're a part of making the rules in the first place, you know? I think too often we just accept what's like, oh, this is the way things are, when it's like, no, actually, we all have a part in making things the way they are.
I think Christy brought up a good point how like we should just research. All these resources are at the tip of our hands. But I think as an Asian American, like a lot of us feel like that's not an option for us because we're not taught to like be proactive and like research these topics. Even for me, like I don't even know where to begin. Like I'm so intimidated. What do I even Google? Like what I don't like what do I look at? I don't know. And
I think Asian Americans, we're awesome, but Asian Americans are taught how to play a game, right? But we're not taught how to make games. Okay, so for example, grades, right?
Yeah.
It's like, how do I and my kids get the best grades ever, right? But we don't realize, are grades even important? Are there other things? It's like, no, we just get so consumed. And it's like in that way we're like athletes of the mind, right? We're really good at that, but we get too caught up in it sometimes that we forget that, wait, how is this game actually affecting our well-being, ourselves as a community? We just get so competitive, right? Another example is like saving money. Like, I think frugality is like a cliche of Asian American people, but that in itself is a game. You're like, how can I save the most money, right?
And even in so like talking about grades or money, it's like, what is the point of doing that, right? Like, I'm getting good grades in order to, and then is there another way to do that? So it'd be like reframing the rules.
Exactly.
I think as a community, as Asian Americans, most of us is like, get the pretty good job, like wear the basic clothes, just get by in life.
To blend in, right? Because you know? You don't want to be someone that's controversial to
whatever
is out there, because I guess we're taught to just, you know, again, put our heads down and work and do good and get good jobs, get good pay, and help out the family. And then that's like a successful life.
The game is optional. It's always optional. Asian Americans especially get caught in this haze of like, it's not an option, it's the only thing, only way.
You actually bring up a really good point in your book about the weapon versus the warrior.
Yeah.
Right? So
Asian Americans are such good weapons, but we don't let ourselves be warriors.
Right. Yeah. So for our listeners, the weapon is someone who's utilized, right? So you work for a company, you're super skilled, like the best performer of whatever it is. You're the best person for someone else. When you're the weapon, you're not the warrior who's actually trying to like dictate your own future and like investing in your own future. You're doing it for someone else.
Right. And I think it's like, it's really tantalizing because it's like, okay, if I ask any of you three, like, do you want to be objectified? You're like, no, like I'm too smart for that. Right. And we know that we don't want to be objectified. We know we don't want to be sexually objectified, but we're allowing ourselves to become utility objects. And we don't even realize it. And why is because they sell it to us really well. They're like, they're not like, oh, do you want to be an object? It's like, do you want to be this amazing weapon? Like, you'd be so powerful. You'd be so like, everyone would want to work with you. Like, and I think our parents, our Asian American parents, are teaching us to be amazing weapons.
Right.
Right. But really like true power lies in being the warrior, but it's scarier because a weapon can never be wrong, right? You're able to be perfect as a weapon, but you don't make choices as a weapon. Someone else uses you and they make choices of how to use you.
Right.
But when you make choices of how to use you, sometimes you might be wrong, right? Or you're going to make mistakes and you're going to have to learn from them. And that's super scary. Mm-hmm. Like, so there's safety in being a weapon versus a warrior.
So we have a lot of our listeners who write in and ask us. They don't say, like, how do you help me become a warrior? But they do ask questions about, like, so I'm kind of, like, stuck in this job. And it's, like, you know, medical school or, like, you know, in lawyers or whatever it is, right? Very, like, almost like standard Asian jobs that your parents expect for you. And they always ask us, like, how do you guys, you know, find these creative projects, passion projects that you do? Like, essentially, how do you become a warrior for yourself, right? So I guess if you were to give our listeners maybe, like, one or two tips on how to, like, get to that path, that'd be great.
So I think all of my advice and exercises kind of fall into, like, two categories, zooming in or zooming out. So we could start off with zooming out. Like, if you don't know what you want, you could zoom out. And just look at your entire life. Just imagine it, like all the possibilities. And maybe even like write a eulogy for yourself. This is kind of dark, but it's really fun. You know, you could write, Krista Suh was a, you know, it's like you know, yeah. she passed away on this day and like this is her life and so on. Because there's this whole idea of, you know, I didn't make this up, of not living for your resume, but for your eulogy, right? And so if you're not sure what you want to do, what step to take, think really big and think about your whole life and what do you want to be remembered for in that life. So like if you're a lawyer now, do you want to be remembered for like, and then she went to an even bigger law firm? Like that's not going to end up in your eulogy. Like you know what I mean? Instead, it's like, do you want to be known for like philanthropy in your local area? Do you want to be known for knitting people like funny gifts or sending cards to? Like you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like these special stories that come up and become like really unique because it's really you. The other thing I talk about, so that's like a zoom out type of exercise, and I have them in my book too, but a zooming in type of exercise is like the Midas touch, I call it, where you make a list of everything you touch in a day, like everything. So you wake up and it's like, okay, I just touched my pillow, my sheets. I like get out of bed and my feet touch this rug I have there. And then I walk over and I touch the toothbrush and whatever. Like, you know, so you just make this list. It could be like 100 or 200 things, right? But then like really drill down. This is about zooming in, right? Of how did that make me feel? And you could start improving your life in these small ways. But the reason why I talk about zooming in is that I think it's really important to know how you feel about specific things, because then you know what you want and then you know what to go after, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it gets you really clear. Like, for example, maybe you think that you love your job. But seriously, do you? Like, when you turn in something, do you love the moment you click send? Does that feel good, like, in your body? When you see your coworkers in the morning, are you like, yay? Or are you like, ugh? You know? Yeah. Like, and so, because that's actually what your job is made of, all these tiny, tiny moments, right?
Wait, it's a side question. Because me and Helen were talking about this actually on the way to this recording. We're like, we're weapons. We're not warriors. I think it's really difficult when you work at corporate 9-to-5 because you're working someone else's, like, I'm doing something for, like, my CEO or whatever, right? But how do you become warriors at a corporate job?
I guess the question is also, like, we need good weapons to be utilized, right? Like, warriors need weapons. People need to be weapons as well, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the way, when I read that section of your book, the way I thought about it was like the main difference between a weapon and a warrior is that a warrior knows why they're doing something, right? And the thing they're doing is like serving that. So I feel like even if you are working like the same thing in the same job, someone could be a weapon and someone else could be a warrior. If I'm doing like a corporate job and I really don't like it, it's disconnected from what I want. But if I know exactly why I'm at that job, it's to feed my family, it's to pay my mortgage. Isn't that kind of being a warrior in the same thing? So
I think so, yeah, because then you're choosing. Again, the women's right to choose. I think I have an exercise in my book. It's like a language thing where instead of saying have to, you say I choose to.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
So it's like – so maybe someone's writing in and it's like, I don't know. Like, I'm not – I don't really like my job. I have to – go in every day at 7 and do, it's like, you choose to go in at 7, like, you know.
So I know we've been talking sort of in the context of Asian Americans, because we are all Asian American women here. And there's a term that's going around called intersectional feminism, which is essentially the idea that feminism is told through the perspective of maybe more of a white woman. So if you think about Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In, it does have this haze of white privilege to it, right? Mm-hmm. I guess as a woman of color.
Are you quoting my book?
I am.
The intro, the haze. Lifting the haze.
So as a woman of color, how do you feel like your efforts as an Asian woman has been different from other women feminists who are white?
Yeah, I think Asian Americans, it's interesting because our experience is different from a white feminist, but it's also different from a black feminist. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I think it's really interesting that my good friend Milk, who is a singer-songwriter, she just got signed to Atlantic, her EP came out, and she actually blurbed my book. So her song, Quiet, went viral at the march. She was on the Samantha Bee show singing it, and it was called the unofficial anthem of the Women's March. And guess what? Like, Krista Suh, her pussy hat became the unofficial, like, symbol of the march, right? The symbol of the movement. Milk's real name is Connie Lim. Hmm. And she's Asian American. She's Chinese American. I'm Chinese Korean American. Asian Americans came up with the biggest creative contributions, like, that are widely recognized, right? For the women's movement. And no one talks about it. It's like, oh, guess what? They're like, Asian women are there. Like, you know, and they're contributing in this really amazing way.
Right.
And I remember, like, you know, in the first, like, sort of storm of interviews, like, kind of mentioning it here and there, and no one really, like, wanted to run with that, you know, which I found really interesting. And I was like, is it the system, or is it because, like, the audience isn't calling for stories like that? Is it both? But I do think that Asian American women have a double whammy of being quiet, or being expected to be quiet. And so we have to work doubly hard to get over that and create, like, a really safe environment for us to speak up.
Right.
We're considered, like, white minority, like a model minority, like, when it suits, you know, the patriarchy, basically. And we're considered, like, people of color when it suits us. Sort of like, we get to get, they sort of fit us in as needed. So there's been some controversy with the hat from the left, actually. So having to do intersectionalism, which is like, oh, the hat is, the pussy hat is pink and thus is only about white women, right? Because it's like, and that never even occurred to me that, like,
like, and the vulva.
The vulva, like, apparently, I didn't know this, all right? It was on the forefront of my mind that, like, oh, women's, white women's vulvas are apparently pink, and thus, like, and the thing is, like, we're not wearing vaginas on our heads, or cat ears, but people are like, oh, that means the pussy hat is really white and anti-people of color. I'm like, hello, like, you know, like,
That's going deep just to, like, stir up some...
Right. And, you know, the thing is, from day one, day zero, it was never about flesh color, right? Like, and as, like, I've talked about earlier. But it occurred to me that, like, oh, like, the controversy isn't so much that they think the pussy hat is wrong. It's just that the pussy hat has suddenly become, to some people, a symbol of white feminism and what's wrong about feminism, right? At first, I was like, oh, like, I wanted people to stop using it that way. But I realized, like, you know what? Like, their criticism isn't about the pussy hat. It's about white feminism. And I share that criticism. And if they choose to use a symbol, this as a symbol of that, there's, there's nothing I could do about it. Like, when I put, like, a hat out or, like, a book out, I can't go around to every individual person and be like, Helen, did you understand exactly what I meant? And, like, you know, I can't, like, force people like that. And so everyone has their own interpretation. And I also think that it's a mistake to constantly, like, criticize how people are doing things, where, like, for example, like, the pussy hat, people criticize us, like, why are you using pink? Do you use a more dignified color, you know? like, don't protest that way. But I would never go to Colin Kaepernick, who is a football player, and he's taking a knee during the national anthem. I would never go up to him and be like, Colin, don't protest that way. Football is sacred. Like, you know, it's like, I don't, you know, but like, similarly, I just cannot go to someone with this grievance and say, like, don't protest that way. The pussy hat is sacred. Mm-hmm. Like, I think the pussy hat is magical, but it's not sacred. And I think it's language to be used. And right now it's being used really effectively. I think, like, for example, someone put a pussy hat on a Harriet Tubman statue, and the Black community, you know, there's a lot of discussion about it, and it was healthy discussion, even though it might sound angry or critical. But some people in the Black community felt the pussy hat was co-opting a hero of their own movement, like, by doing that. And some people felt it was an inclusive gesture. Mm-hmm. And there is no right or wrong, which is can be kind of scary when you first enter politics, because, like, especially as an Asian American, you're like, I want to do it the right way. And you're like, right. Is there no right way? Fuck. Like, you know, like, you know, and
what
that's
do I stand
really,
behind,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And so I think just accepting that there's no perfect way to do this, to protest, to be political, to be active, or even to be in solidarity. I think to approach intersectionality, yes, we have to be more inclusive and so forth, but we also have to lose perfectionism. You know, my book is a lot about losing perfectionism in yourself, but we also need to do that as a movement.
Right. When people found out that it was you, an Asian American woman, who started this project, how did they react, especially non-Asian people?
Well, it's two things. I think, first of all, a lot of people, they can't believe a person started it. White, Asian, female, male. Mm-hmm. They're just like, wait, it came from somewhere? Like, you know, it would just... And I think, like, we forget that there's magic in our lives all the time. Because we think, like, oh, magic and movie magic stuff happens out there. My life is normal. I know normal people. I do normal things. No, you are an abnormal person doing abnormal things with abnormal friends. Like, everyone's so interesting and magical, but we forget that. It's like another version of the haze. I think it just seems like this hat, it spreads so much that it's hard to believe that it came out of one person's mind. But I'm really proud that I, you know, came up with idea, channeled the idea, like, however you want to say it. But I don't think that's what makes me special. I think women, girls, people of color, everyone, we have great ideas all the time. Mm-hmm. But especially women, girls, and people of color, we are taught to talk ourselves out of those ideas, right? So I think if I'm special at all, it's not because I had a great idea. We all have great ideas. It's that I chose to nurture my idea instead of squelch it, instead of being like, oh, like, that could never happen, or what if it fails, or, like, I don't have the experience for that. I was like, oh, let's just try it, right? And that's why I wrote a book not about so much about, like, look at me. I'm so, like, I didn't want to write a book about the past in that way. I wanted to write a book for the present and for the future, where give people tools to nurture their own amazing, quote unquote, crazy ideas, right? Because that's everywhere. Anyway, and then I think, secondly, people are really, like, surprised because they assumed it was, yeah, like, a white woman activist. What else have I heard? Someone in New York wanted to meet me and perhaps collaborate. And they were like, they were so blunt. They were like, yeah, we thought you would be an angry white lesbian with red spikes in your hair. I was like, yeah, that's really specific. Okay. Like, you know, and a lot of people also, like, you know, maybe, like, a more matronly, older, like, white woman or something. But no, it was me.
All right, so Krista, we do have a question for you, and I want to direct this towards Janet, because she's our girl that's actively dating, or semi-actively dating.
Yeah. So to step away from politics for a second, you mentioned in your book that you've dated a pretty wide age range of men, right? So you dated guys who are, like, younger than you and 22 at the time. You were probably, like, in your late 20s, I think.
Yeah,
you mentioned.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you've also dated men who are, like, 55.
Yeah.
So that's like three decades.
whoa.
Could you share with
one
us,
of the guys
like,
I dated did become a grandfather, like,
whoa,
like,
while you were dating him?
Yeah.
Wow.
How long did you date him for?
Just on and off, a few years. Yeah. Like, yeah.
What was the appeal? I'm like very curious. Yeah. About this.
You know,
the gilf.
I don't think the age itself was an appeal. I think it was the fact that it was his personality, and I have to say, like, so I went on a dating website a while ago, and I was like, well, like, this guy I dated, I like him, and he's, like, you know, 20-plus years old. He's, like, say, 55 mm-hmm. at the time, right? So I was like, I'm going to put my age range of, like, you know, from 22 to 55 because, like, I've dated that, I like them, and great. And then, like, the people I got in were, like, horrible. They looked like Santa Claus. I was like, oh, I guess, like, the 55-year-old I dated was not, like, the typical.
Yeah, right. George Clooney of the group.
yeah, like, something like that. Yeah, so it's, like, yeah, actually, George Clooney is 55 or something like that. So, like,
I could see that. You see that, Mel?
Yeah, he's hot.
Dating a George
Clooney. Well, I have to say, I think there's also a bit of a blind spot thing where it's, like, when I see, like, a couple with a big age range, I'm like, ugh, gross. And then I will go on a date with a guy, and I'm like, oh, this is totally fine. Like, you know, so there's a little bit of, like, double standard selective thinking there, I think. But, you know, it's just really about, like, who I connect with, I think. Yeah.
So were there, like, personality things about that guy who was 55 that you also found in someone who was 22? Or, like, what made me think of specifically of a younger guy you've dated and, like, what attracted you to him?
Oh, he was really cute. but also, I guess with either extreme, I didn't realize how far they were for me. So there's that. They were both really funny and creative. And I think no matter what age, I think that youthful energy of exploring was both there. I will say, I think, like, I don't do so well with guys exactly my age. I feel like guys exactly my age aren't, like,
emotionally there?
They aren't emotionally there. They're very, like, self-involved. They're very, like, I mean, there's so many, like, assumptions here, but you guys get me. Yeah. But also, like, I think guys who are a lot older actually nicer to you on dates.
They, like, or they know how to treat women. Yeah. Because they've dated around. I do feel like you're a bit of an old soul. How's the sex?
You beat me to it, Helen.
You don't have the answer, but
I mean, one
totally could.
Does one age have more endurance than the other, stamina, like, you know.
Or do they get back pain? It's so funny. Easily, like, so. they will tell you themselves, they're like, oh, like, the older guys are like, younger guys, they don't last this long. And the younger guys are like, older guys, like, they take forever to get back. But me, it's like 2 minutes. Like, yeah, like, so it's like they talk about it. I don't even have to.
That is true. That is true. When I've dated, I guess, like, a younger guy, he was very focused on, like, the age difference and having to sell himself. Like, he was compensating for that,
right?
And then if a guy's, like, much older, it's the same thing. He feels like he has to compensate for that or, like, explain. But
so I love it. It's like, they're trying to, like, win you over. Well, also, like, I don't know. I feel like there's a trend now where, like, you see, I always thought Viagra was used by, like, older guys, like, 50s, 60s, 70s, like that. But, like, I see now, like, men in their, like, mid, late 30s and early 40s using Viagra to give them, like, that extra,
do they,
like
show you? They're like, I'm about to pop this pill, so get ready.
Well, it's like kind of a mix between, like, guy friends and, like, people I'm dating.
Okay.
And so, yeah, they're like, yeah, I take, like, a half to, like, help me or something. I was like, wow. Really? Like, but I've seen that happening more and more.
It's like steroid for the dick.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. But what's really funny is that when they get older, they don't see very well. And so they're like, oh, I can't read the.
Oh,
like,
no.
Yeah. Oh, no. Like, that's like really small medical.
Oh, my gosh. But that is, I think that's speaking to the state of dating culture, right? Where if you're dating a bunch of people all the time, you're constantly trying to impress. Versus, like, in the past where you only dated, you're dating in, like, long-term relationships, there isn't this need to impress this person. So it's sad to me that guys are resorting to Viagra in order to, like,
It's sad, but I'm also, like, finally, they, like, are carrying, like, you know what I mean? It's like, this is so mean because it's better that, like, all of us get less neurotic about our looks, but it makes me feel like, oh, like, if women have to be this neurotic about looks, at least guys should join us.
That's
like,
so true. Like, that's so true. So you're doing something for me for once. This is great.
No, exactly. And I, by the way, not to make everything so serious, but, like, I think the onus of birth control should fall on men and women. That's off mostly on women.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so we have to take, you know, we don't have to, but like right. there's
we choose
these, like,
to.
Oh, choose to. Or like, but the choices offered aren't that many where right. you're like, okay, I can take these hormones to change my body. And then they don't even really develop male contraceptive pills.
Right. Right. Or I know
it's not funded.
Right. It's right. Exactly. Popular. Like there yeah. has been male contraceptives.
And
but,
also,
like,
did you read that funded. Same thing I did? Like Probably. This Danish study where they were trying the male contraceptive pill and men were reported feeling like
yeah.
really like I'm fatigued bloated right and bloated.
Like welcome to like our monthly experience.
Yeah. And it's like, oh.
All right. Thank you, Krista, so much for joining us today. This was an amazing opportunity for us to get to know you. And for our listeners, you have so many gems that you offered us in this episode. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about where to find you online and what you're doing next?
Thank you guys so much. I like had such a good time. I was so looking forward to this. And I love like reveling in my Asian-ness, actually. Like, you know.
It's the right place to do it.
Yeah. So you can find me on KristaSuh.com. So that's KristaSuh.com. And from there, you can follow me on Instagram at KristaSuh. On Facebook, I'm Ms. KristaSuh. but, you know, find me because I really would love to stay connected. And I would love to have more followers who are Asian American because I feel like when I wrote this book, DIY Rules for a WTF World, I'm on tour right now for it. I kind of wrote it for with you in mind, right? Like, or like the younger version of me.
Mm-hmm.
And the subtitle is How to Speak Up, Get Creative, and Change the World. So I'm putting out more like supplementary content for the book to like help people through. So that's going to be on my website. Join my mailing list. It's really fun, I promise. that's where to find me. Please come by.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Krista is a super amazing, inspirational ABG.
Mm-hmm.
And we are so humbled to have had her on our podcast.
And we hope that you guys will go and check out her book, DIY Rules for a WTF World. You can find it on her website, KristaSuh.com, or just any Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com. It's a great read, and we know she's done work that's like political in nature, but the book is very good for just if you are growing up and trying to figure out how to tap into your creativity.
And please write us at AsianBossGirl@gmail.com. We're very curious. We want to hear what you guys think about this episode. Again, you could follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and please subscribe to us on iTunes at ABG-AsianBossGirl. Thank you so much.
Bye. Bye.